Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Hello, TERFs and trannies. You are listening to Heterodorks. I am Nina Paley, your co-host.
And I am Corinna Cohn, your other co-host. And today we have a special guest with us. Our guest is Katie Montgomery.
Hi.
And Katie is a feminist, an LGBT rights advocate, an atheist, a metalhead, and an insect enthusiast. That is Katie's bio from Katie's blog. Welcome to Heterodorks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. We've been trying to put this together for a good part of 2022, and we are finally doing it.
Yeah, exciting.
And I think based on our release schedule, it's likely that this is going to be an early Christmas present for the Heterodorks audience.
Exciting. Happy Christmas, everyone.
Happy Christmas. And you guys do Boxing Day as well, right?
Yeah. Though it's just like another day of eating Christmas dinner, but cold. So it's probably the best food day because I like Christmas dinners, but eating like cold Christmas dinner out the fridge the next day for breakfast, it's like perfect. So.
Makes sense. That's what we do here the day after Thanksgiving.
A little bit. Right, yeah. Oh, that was recent, wasn't it? Hope you had respectively good ones.
Well, I did, but Nina's a vegetarian.
Oh, so am I. You can. There's lots of good vegetarian feast options now. So.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I just I went to somebody else's house for a vegetarian one, whereas my mom had a nice carnivorous one.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I just can't imagine having an enjoyable holiday meal without meat. It's just hard to place.
It's just amazing you and I get along, Corinna. And even go out to eat sometimes.
Well, tofu is good.
Yeah.
Is it?
With enough num oil, you bet.
Yeah, Chinese tofu is good. So, Katie, I want to bring up a topic that I think is timely and relevant and interesting, at least. Tragically, there was a shooting in the United States. Well, I mean, it's the United States. I have to be more specific because we had probably one this morning that I haven't learned about yet. But there was one at a gay nightclub in Colorado Springs that's called Club Q. And a man, young man came in with a AR-15, I think is what they said. And he was able to shoot almost two dozen people, killing five of them before he was detained and arrested. And the immediate aftermath of this is that there were accusations that the online environment and social media that has noticeably become more critical of LGBT things or critical. LGBTQ things over the last 2 years, that this was a contribution to what led up to the shooting. And then I think 2 days later, it turns out that the shooter's lawyers claim, anyway, that the shooter identifies as non-binary. And so there's been a lot of narratives that have been competing over the last couple of days about how we are supposed to interpret this shooting. So maybe setting aside the fact that there are shootings all of the time in America, so the fact that it happened is hard to distinguish from a lot of other shootings mechanically. The context of it seems to be the more important part. I'm wondering what your take on this whole event has been on the online reaction.
The first thing I'll just pick up on is when you said it's becoming more critical of LGBT people. And I guess you could say critical is like criticizing doesn't have to be constructive. It could just be pointless negative criticism. But I feel like that's like an under exaggeration of the environment. It's more that it's spiraling pretty quickly into open hate speech and, you know, calls to wipe people out and all kinds of things from mainstream sources. So critical is technically true, but I don't know if I'd use that word because it kind of, I think, hides it a little bit. I do think that it was a hate crime. I think it was motivated by hatred of LGBT people. I mean, if you've seen the interview with the father of the shooter, who's a very strange and kind of tragic person, like the thing that he cared about most was that his son wasn't gay. Like that was the first thing he mentioned and was like relieved and didn't seem to care at all that he had, you know, killed a load of people. Sometimes you get these mass shootings and lots of the time it's a revenge thing. You know, a kid goes back to a school that they used to go to. I think that's quite common. But when someone travels to somewhere they haven't, you know, they don't frequent all the time and it's not their local place, it's less a revenge thing and it's more likely to be political. And I just think looking at this person's output online for the last however many years and, you know, their history and all these other kind of things, I just think it's just transparently anti-LGBT hatred. I think it would be impossible to prove for certain or the other way that what someone's consumed and what single action caused them to flip over to the point where they decided to take a gun to shoot people. But the kind of constant fear-mongering about LGBT people, the fact that this place had one of these drag brunches or whatever they're called, where they're story time reading to kids, and how the Republican media machine has been, you know, selling the idea that this is some kind of paedophile thing. I just think it'd be ridiculous to claim that wasn't a contributor or a large driver of this.
So I held back on my conclusions on this particular case because I thought that it was going to be important to see evidence of what this what the shooter was posting on social media, or if they had any diaries or searches of their computer, because that often turns up some evidence. And I wanted to learn more before jumping to that conclusion, which I felt validated in waiting when the defendant's lawyers said that he identifies as non-binary. Because I'm not even jumping to the conclusion that this is a ploy to try to avoid hate crime charges. I think that this person may have maybe a borderline personality disorder issue, and that it's possible. I don't know that this is the case, but I'm open to the possibility that he had a severe internalized homophobia, and that this is his way of projecting that.
Is it the case, sorry, I'm not an expert on US law, but is it the case if it was non-binary or gay or, you know, some other identity typically associated with LGBT bars, that it wouldn't be a hate crime charge? Because in the UK, that wouldn't matter at all. Like if a gay person went in and shot a load of gay people and it was clear that it was motivated by homophobia, then it would still be a hate crime.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on law at all.
Because I've heard that and it seems ridiculous to me, because the idea that, you know, an LGBT person couldn't do an LGBT hate crime.
Yeah.
I just think that's just false. It's like it's like one of those weak arguments. You say, oh no, they can't be sexist because they're a woman. You know, it's like a real cheap kind of get out argument from people who don't really understand the environment.
In my opinion. I think for a hate crime charge to stick, you have to show intent.
Mm.
Have to prove that they were trying to do it on the basis of creating fear and terror in that group.
Yeah. Well, I would I don't really have much faith in the law defending LGBT people. I don't know much about the state this happened in. It's all very different for me looking at the US, because some of your states, maybe I would have more faith in the law and some I wouldn't at all. If this happened in the UK, I suspect it probably would end in a hate crime charge, but I don't really have much faith in the system. So, but I would feel more comfortable in, you know, reviewing it and coming to, I think it's easier, you know, sometimes you get in a situation where you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt or whatever that something is a hate crime or whatever. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is still one, even if you can't necessarily prove it. So I don't know. It's kind of just speculation, I guess. But
one of the immediate after effects that I felt uncomfortable with online is that there are a couple of activists who I follow in the trans space. And the way that the shooting was characterized was, they're trying to kill us all now. They're coming after us. They really do want to eliminate us. This is genocide that is happening right now. And I was really uncomfortable with that for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is that there have been multiple murders in my neighborhood just in the last year, unfortunately, this is just a property, I think, of the United States. Homicides are so horrifying. Common here. What's that?
That's horrifying. There's been none I'm aware of in my area at all. So.
Oh, yeah. I could, I think I could hold my breath right now. And if I ran, I could run across two different spots where homicides happened in my neighborhood without having to draw another breath. Which I might be overestimating my lung capacity, but I think it would be pretty close. So to me, there's an aspect of this. This is like, there are so many mass shootings in the United States. To say that this particular event out of the 400 others that happened in 2022 is proof that there's genocide against LGBT people. Because to me, this is one out of 400 other events. I worry that we are getting members of the LGBTQ community keyed up and paranoid that they are being specifically targeted for extermination. I'm worried about that message.
Yeah, I mean, there's a careful line to walk between causing panic and fear in the community and just saying the reality of what's happening and where things are heading. Undeniably, there are people calling for genocide against LGBT people, even sometimes people who you can vote for in elections. And certainly leaders of hate groups and big right-wing media personalities are saying, well, you know, if they didn't have all these drag brunches, all the murders would stop, you know, that kind of suggestive pushing in that direction. And I think looking at the ideologies of lots of these people who I spend a lot of my time arguing with, you know, lots of them do want to create a world without LGBT people. They think that it's a choice and a societal ill that can be erased from society. But it doesn't just suddenly flip to being a genocide. There's kind of a slow and steady progression, I guess. Or, well, maybe slow and steady is wrong. Sometimes it is fast and sometimes it isn't steady. But there is a progression to it. And there's this kind of phrase that I've heard a few times, which is like, the path to fascism is paved with people telling you you're over-exaggerating and being hyperbolic. Looking at previous genocides, it's not like they have one election, they vote in this guy, and then the next day they're doing death camps. There's all of this scapegoating for years, building up terror about whichever minority group they're coming for in the media. And sometimes they're doing it for more than one group at once. And it's not necessarily some big top-down orchestrated plan, but it's a sort of a system which all feeds back into itself. And, you know, maybe one group is fear-mongered against for a while and then they move on to another one. But it does get worse and worse. And I don't think that there's no chance of, you know, some America spiraling into a proper fascist, like, grim scenario where they are doing death camps. I don't think that's impossible. But if you get this situation with big activists, and the problem is lots of activists are like me. They're like, I'm not some kind of well-trained professional, done a degree in activism. I'm just like some idiot who likes to argue on the internet. And that, you know, I panic about this stuff and I have to consider a lot now because of the size of my platform, what I actually say and how I frame it. And that's quite a burden really for me. And maybe I'm just kind of whining about nothing, but you know, when you see these groups getting more power and you see politicians start using their dog whistles and you know what they're advocating for and you know where this is going and all this kind of stuff, you just want to scream like, please, people need to look at this. Someone needs to do something about this. But then you can easily cause a panic and then people stop thinking straight and then, you know, it affects people's mental health and we're less capable to fight back against it, et cetera, et cetera. But I am kind of giving my spiel here is what I would say in general to someone. And I'm aware that I don't know if you both describe yourselves as gender critical, but what I would call gender critical, I assume you both are.
Ish.
And maybe this would land different to the listeners, perhaps, who are gender critical. But that's my general position. Sorry, that was a long answer. Stop me if I start ranting.
Not at all. Just to follow up on that gender critical part, I think it's fair to describe us generally as having that attitude, but we've also been critical, gender critical on heterodox.
Just critical.
Yeah. Just critical.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I'm aware that there's a wide range of views and you know, it's complicated, and when I want to project views onto someone, I feel like I could confidently talk about the gender critical movement. And if I spent some time researching your various public actions and who you had supported or not, then maybe I'd challenge you on, you supported this person who does want to wipe trans people out, or maybe you don't.
Yeah.
And but yeah, it's better to just hear from people. Though saying that, I think lots of gender critical people just lie. I mean, being honest, I think that the majority of gender critical people want to create a world without trans people, and they know it's not very politically convenient right now, at least in the UK, to say that. So they don't. Maybe that's a bit confrontational, sorry.
I have questions. It's just that you said so much stuff in response to Corinna's question before. I wanted to know if Corinna had questions on that before
I'll ask questions.
I'll
stop ranting off.
No, we want to get to all of it. Yeah. What is the gender critical movement?
Oh, good question. So I think how I'll describe it is I think it's quite UK focused, but then I'm UK focused, and maybe you feel that's unfair. But I think that gender critical is just kind of the politically correct term for like anti-trans activists. I think it grew out of TERFism, which I would say was distinct from gender critical. And here, I know that some people think TERF is a slur, whatever. What I'm trying to do is describe here a group of people who are radical feminists and have radical feminist worldviews, or at least largely radical feminist worldviews, who also hold views about trans people, which we can go into in a second. But I think as TERF, started learning what TERF was, people didn't really like it being labelled as that. And so they kind of rebranded to gender critical. But I think as the gender critical movement has grown and got a lot more political and media support, that it's just kind of merged with the general conservative movement, and it's moved further and further away from radical feminism, whilst keeping some of its language and acts, I guess, like kind of the symbols of feminism. And I think today, where we sit, maybe 4 years ago, I would have said gender critical was still mainly people with some kind of feminist background. I don't think that's true today, certainly not in the UK mainstream space. But when I was just mentioning about gender critical's views on trans people, I guess what I would say, I mean, trans exclusionary does kind of sum it up, but I'm aware that you sometimes get the JK Rowlings of the world trying to do a word game here. What I mean by that is lots of the time, or maybe all the time, more gender critical people would say that trans women don't deserve the protections from misogyny that other women have. I know that the key point is they think trans women are men, but I think that's kind of irrelevant from creating laws and protections for people. The point is trans women face misogyny and therefore should have legal protection from it, and similar with other prejudices, which we can go into. But that's kind of the summary. But I would say that, you know, the mainstream of gender critical is people like JK Rowling, who are openly hostile to all trans legislation that would improve trans people's lives, and spend a lot of time promoting people who are openly advocating to remove all trans rights in the UK. Again, a long answer.
One of the things that I did this year is I gave public testimony in favor of a bill that would limit the participation in women and girls sports to natal females.
Yeah, I've seen the video.
And I did that on the basis that I just don't think that it's in any way fair for somebody who has been through male puberty, androgenization, to compete in sports where there are awards granted for the winners. I don't think it's fair for them to, for people who've gone through male puberty, to compete against women and girls. So the basis of my argument is not that I am against anybody who identifies as trans, but on the basis that if there's not a distinct sports category for women and females, that they just won't be able to have a level playing ground. There are other people who support legislation on the basis that they find trans-identified people to be morally repugnant, and they would support that legislation just on the basis that it creates restrictions. And I would not agree with motives like that at all, but I am in favor of making sure that rights and laws that have been created for the purpose of granting protections on the basis of sex are protected. When I hear somebody say something like, try to remove rights for trans people, I want to make sure that, like, in cases where I'm trying to advocate for protecting women's sports, for instance, that it's only on the basis of sex. It's not against trans people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm aware of this argument. I think that it requires accepting a premise about what exactly sex is and what exactly the point of these laws are. And, you know, we can argue about either of those things. But I think that you will sometimes see the situation where I will say, you know, this group, for example, Women's Place UK or Women's Declaration International or Fair Play for Women, it's one of those groups, they want to ban, or LGB Alliance, they want to ban me from the women's toilets at work. And that's true. They've all signed this declaration saying that's what they want to do. And then they'll say, no, we just want to ban males. And I'm like, yeah, but this is you worming out or facing up to the reality of what you're actually advocating for. Because men don't, like, cis men don't use women's toilets. That's not the issue that's being complained about. You're specifically targeting it against people like me who do use the women's toilet. That's the whole point of this. If I didn't use women's toilets, you wouldn't have signed a declaration saying we want to ban all males. It's like a way of avoiding criticism for a policy which is just explicitly transphobic.
I think Corinna and I have sort of let go of arguing about toilets. That's a distraction. So but we will argue about jails and shelters for victims of violence.
Yeah, for sure. And so I think that there's a whole range of things here. And I would say, like, the mainstream of gender critical does want to ban me from the toilet. And I think it's a completely ridiculous position for a number of reasons. But even if you were trying to, like, steel man the gender critical position, going for toilets is just ridiculous. Because, like you say, sports and prisons and women's shelters are more important than, you know, as a focus and a place of more intense argument and etc. And I think it's much easier for me to say, this person wants to ban me from the toilets at work. That's fucking ridiculous. Sorry, can I swear? I didn't mean to swear.
Yeah, no,
didn't check. That is ridiculous. And I think that sells well to everyone I've ever met, most of the public. Focusing on those, I can see why, you know, we can discuss that in a second. But I guess one point I would make is you get these kind of, like, we're not talking about gender critical people here so much. And I apologize if this kind of comes across offensive as a comparison, but I do think it's true, and this is my position. But you might have heard of the alt-right pipeline, where you have these people who are, like, extreme far-right white supremacists, and they hold all of the, like, neo-Nazi views. And then they're friends with these people who don't really, they're not quite on board with that, but they're totally sympathetic of it. And then they're friends with these people who aren't not friends with the Nazis, but they're friends with the next people. And then all the way up to then someone who's just a mainstream, like, often computer game player on YouTube, who just recommends some of these slightly right-wing people. And then, you know, some kid gets into it and falls all the way down this slope. And the issue here is that none of them are willing to openly condemn the next one down the line, because if they do, they'll get so much pushback, they'll be outed from the entire, like, ecosystem of this kind of outright pipeline. And I think that is very true as a mechanism for gender critical in a way that it isn't for trans rights, for example, trans rights advocates. So, and the reason I say that is I have spent a lot of my time, I mean, I basically talked with gender critical people every single day for 6 years, just trying to get people to, you know, everyone else described themselves as not an extremist. And I'm like, okay, well, let's pick someone who is obviously an extremist. You don't have to necessarily publicly condemn them to everyone. We're talking in DMs, maybe we're even talking on the phone. Can you just condemn this? Can you say, not just that you don't really, like, you don't support these people who want to ban me from the toilets, but could you say, I actively condemn them, and I am politically opposed to this person. Because, like, I'm politically opposed to someone who wants to get rid of all sporting categorization, or someone who wants to get rid of all, you know, women's shelters and make them all unisex. I'm politically opposed to those people, and they are not my allies, and you won't see me arguing side by side with them, because as soon as I found out that was their position, I would argue with them. Like, that's how it, and I just don't see that. So, it, like, if you two don't want to ban me from the toilet, great. That means that you're not extreme. But maybe if you're just, like, buying Posey Parker merch or, you know, defending WDI, then what's the difference? You know, you're still supporting them. So that's my response to that.
I heartily recommend that instead of buying any adult human female merch, that you go to our store and instead buy the adult human weirdo merch.
I liked your slogan, sex is real, people are weird, or something like that. That's good.
Thank you. That was mine. So, you know, gender critical, whatever that is, there is so much infighting, and there are so many factions within it. Somebody on Spinster just the other day, they called me a tranny hugger, which was very offensive because I'm not a hugger. But that's just what they do. And
yeah, I've seen some pretty vile things sent to my cis women friends. I've got a range of people. I used to have some gender critical friends, I guess, but that's kind of got to a point where it just doesn't really happen anymore. But some people who are more central, people who are like ex-gender critical, and they, you know, they get called that, but all the way up to very detailed rape threats are
just all kinds of factions and fighting, and I'm what are they you know, some are disgusted with me for having tranny friends, and you know, JK Rowling, actually quite a few of us, those of us that have tranny friends, they call them our pet trans. Mm-hmm. JK yep. Rowling has her pet trans. Corinna's my pet trans. I'm Corinna's pet turf.
I haven't seen any gender critical with openly criticizing JK Rowling yet. That'll be
you're not hanging out.
Is it? I used to be on Spinster. I was verified on Spinster for a while.
Well, you know, some of them were very, you know, every time, I think they also did this to Maya Forstatter, where there was a picture of her with a tranny friend. And whenever there's a picture of a woman speaking up, a gender critical woman speaking up with a trans person in the picture, they're like, there's your pet trans, tranny hugger. They believe in true trans, stuff like that.
That's interesting because I feel like Maya Forstatter is like the archetype extremist. I'm aware that there are more extreme people for sure, you know, like some who will openly describe me as subhuman or. You know, people who send all these threats and stuff, but in terms of mainstream gender critical, like, she holds really hardline views. Like,
why do you think she has trans friends if she hates trans people so much?
Because it's politically convenient. I think that she doesn't really like them. That's
really
my real position.
Do you think her trans friends don't like her?
I think that I've actually done a YouTube video about this called I'm One of the Good Ones. I think that this is a pattern that you see in all minority groups, and like the classic example is like I'm Not Like the Other Girls, where you suck up to the oppressor in order to escape the oppression, and you try and distance yourself from everyone else by saying, oh yeah, you know, trans people are disgusting and for sure they should be banned from public spaces, but I'm different because I believe sex is real, hashtag sex not gender, or something along those lines.
Wait. Which one of us is the groveling panderer? Is it me or Corinna?
it's me.
It's you. Okay. I'm the oppressor and you're groveling to be the other trannies.
I'm not saying you, Nina, are necessarily the same as Maya Forstater in being politically friends with trans people. But I think, you know, it's quite common in the gender critical movement to have like an open alliance with maybe I shouldn't name people, one of the three famous gender critical trans women and one of the five, you know, openly D-trans gender critical activists. And I don't think in their like if you logically follow through their worldview or just look at their demands that they've made, these people wouldn't exist in their world. They wouldn't be able to live in society. So yeah, it's political in my opinion, which I would be happy to argue in a lot more detail.
I am somebody who thinks that it's possible to work for a world where everybody's rights are protected, their civil rights particularly, but that there are also sex-based protections?
Sex-based rights.
Sex-based rights.
Is that a dog whistle? Is sex-based rights a dog whistle?
Yeah.
Oh, it is?
I can't whistle.
Yeah, for sure.
Sex-based rights.
Because I think, maybe we're kind of spiraling around the drain of going down the what is sex discussion. Maybe you don't want to do that because it can get really boring really fast. But I think that, to me, the gender critical position is a bit like asserting that there are... I'm an atheist. So I don't believe in souls or any supernatural anything. But I think that the gender critical position is the assertion that there are sexed souls that are more important than your biological sex characteristics.
You said that's the gender critical position.
That's the gender critical position.
I think that, I think that I'm aware that the gender criticals would say the exact same about me in reverse, but about gender identity. I think that's because they haven't followed their own assertions through logically to their endpoints, and they haven't even bothered listening to what I have to say at all. Your little slogan from earlier, sex is real, people are weird. I describe myself as weird all the time. So, look at me. But also the first sentence of the most famous thing I've ever written, I can't remember how many views it has, but lots, is sex is real, full stop. And that's not me trying to be like a one of the good ones trans. I think me and Corinna are probably pretty different on our positions. But I think that I'm making the like TRA, trans rights activist argument, and most gender criticals just don't bother listening to what that is. But the reason, certainly, these both tie together in that a gender critical, like the standard stereotypical gender critical person will say that sex is binary, you know, that's like the male force data position, and that it's immutable. And so by binary, they mean literally you're one or the other, and immutable means it can't change. So I'll say, well, what defines that? And they have this belief, oh, it's biology, you know, it's biology, it's female, that's what it is. But like sex is this really hugely complicated biological process, because all of biology is really complicated, and there are no like strict categories in biology at all, apart from apparently just sex. And we get into this situation where if you go down to the detail of it, they don't have a clear definition of sex because there just isn't one. And there'll be these little factions, you know, like the Emma Hilton will say, oh, it's gonad tissue, and then some other gender critical people say, oh, well, it's chromosomes, and then some others will say, oh, well, it's what genitals you were born with, and all these kind of things. But not only are all of these contradictory, I mean, they're 90% the same, but they are contradictory models of the world. But also all of them just have exceptions. But the main point here is, if we did just accept the premise that, say, chromosomes were the thing that defined sex, you can't change chromosomes, totally agree. And when you're looking at chromosomes, if you see someone who's XY, you'll say, oh, they're male chromosomes. Because, you know, the vast majority of men have XY chromosomes. That's just like a fact that we have, you know, a categorization we have made as a society. That doesn't mean that everyone with XY chromosomes is a man. Not even ignoring trans people, they just are some cis women. So if we then said that person is then male, and immutably male, and also that sex not gender, sex-based rights, I mean, to be consistent in the actual position that you're asserting, that you know, this cis woman who has perhaps even given birth, who just happens to be XY, or maybe we, you know, pick another thing, you know, we could instead pick gonad tissue, you know, someone who was born without ovaries. And a good example of that is perhaps Caster Semenya, who is a cis woman, was born a girl, and there are now some gender critical people who assert that she is a man because of their belief in her, what her biology is. But you end up with this situation where you could pick a sex characteristic, but I don't think it aligns with what needs people have. is what I'm saying.
I do want to underline your point briefly in your favor, which is that there has been some really, forgive the word, but I think retarded outbreaks of moral panic in the gender critical universe in the last 18 to 24 months, where you do see descriptions of people born with intersex conditions or DSDs who have followed a female biological developmental path because of that's just how humans can work sometimes. Of these individuals who have XY chromosomes being called he, when it's clear that their biological development path was not towards masculinization at all.
At all?
Possibly? CAIS really flummoxes. Gender criticals and radical feminists. This has been one of the big right. There are really some factions. This happened recently. And I also had to, because the chromosome model seemed so solid. And then it's like, no, there's complete androgen insensitivity syndrome, vanishingly rare, very rare, but it still exists. And then it's like, well, there goes our chromosome model and we have to have something else. So
exactly. There's a good model. The chromosomes, I mean, it's pretty good. Like whatever you say, vanishing rare. Maybe we could say it's 99 point whatever plus percent accurate, but it isn't true. It's a model we've created.
Right. The chromosome. So, you know, some of us had to like really grapple with this, and people said some really stupid things about women with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome. I feel like I've gotten over that hump.
What's your model? Gender.
I'm like a Carol Hooven fan, the developmental. Oh, Carol Hooven. She wrote a great book, Testosterone.
Okay.
And she is aware of these various anomalies, but I just say the developmental pathway. And again, like bathrooms can be a real distraction for these issues. Intersex is another real distraction because DSDs, it's a favorite one where people are like, oh, what about DSDs? That means sex isn't real. It's like, all right, let's just set this aside and talk about most trans people. Okay, most trans people, the vast majority of trans people do not have DSDs. So let's talk about that when there's not ambiguous genitalia or androgen insensitivity, where it's just normal physical development and it's an issue of presentation, identity, and choices that people are making about medicalization and other interventions.
I'm always fine to step back and look at the majority of people, because when we're arguing, or not the majority of people, but whichever groups we're talking about, and to look at general trends. However, if someone is making the strong assertion that sex is binary and they can't give me a definition which splits all humans into one or two groups, then their assertion is unproven or wrong. And that's why I say gender critical is like the belief in sex souls, because the claim that, oh yeah, this person is like unchangeably male. So another way of looking at this is, if, for example, we said sex was defined by chromosomes, and then we made a machine which could change people's chromosomes from XX to XY and vice versa, and then I just did it on you two, like, and then you've just changed sex. I mean, if that's your definition, but what of your life would have changed? Like nothing. And that's kind of why the two parts of my argument here is, one of them is that whatever kind of, we can keep chipping away and trying to find the perfect model, and I actually think there is no way that you're going to come up with any kind of definition that's ever going to result in a binary categorization. But even if you did, it would be so arbitrary and abstract that it just wouldn't reflect the reality of people's lives. So when we do step back, we can say, oh, maybe it's like, you know, gamete potential or developmental pathway, these kind of nebulous terms that no one can actually define. Even if we did just be like, okay, then, like, I've had a male developmental pathway, and, you know, Nina, you've had a female developmental pathway. What does that mean in terms of the reality of my life?
I can answer this.
Yeah.
There are always, like you say, there are always exceptions. even if they're very rare.
But not if it's a binary, there aren't. Because binary means two.
Okay. But I will say that the fact that most, the vast majority of female people can get pregnant is massive. It's, and also, I mean, that's the biggest one. Yeah, vulnerability absolutely. To pregnancy is, and so we can say for certain that there's a category of people that can't get pregnant and don't have that experience. And it shapes your life to such a degree, and in ways that people often don't talk about, like in heterosexual relationships, there's yeah. this huge healthcare aspect of, you know, and women that we don't talk about our urinary tract infections very often. We don't, most don't talk about their abortions, you know, most don't talk about their rushing to the clinic and their vulnerabilities. And it's just massively life-shaping, and there's just a huge difference.
I mean, I absolutely hard agree probably on everything you've said there. Yeah, basically everything you said. I totally agree that pregnancy is like one of the main issues in this space of feminism. And, you know, it's not always talked about, and it affects people's lives, etc. I guess my argument to that is, or my comment to that is, two parts. One is women who don't get pregnant or can't get pregnant obviously still face everyday misogyny all the time and still need protection from it and still need safe spaces, etc. Actually, maybe that's one part. That's my one answer. Okay. I had two and I merged it into one.
Right, right. So you're saying that because not all women can get pregnant, women that can't get pregnant need sex-based protections, and so do trans women. That trans women are a category of women that can't get pregnant.
When you say sex-based protection, I mean, like, we could say, there's different ways to look at this. You could say everyone has the right to an abortion. Like, you could create this world where the law says every single human has a right to abortion. And I'm never going to use that. It doesn't personally directly affect me because I can't get pregnant. And that's true for a lot of people. But you could have that as a law. Or you could say everyone who is capable of getting pregnant should have access to an abortion. And the practical reality of that actual law in text is exactly the same. But when you're campaigning for who this affects, if you just say, oh, you know, people should be able to have abortions, you can end up hiding the fact that the only reason that people campaign against abortions is because of misogyny. Like, they want to control women. And even, you know, it does affect trans men and it does affect non-binary people. And so I often say, you know, women, it's a women's issue and it's targeted at women. And you know, these people pushing for anti-abortion things, they're anti-trans anyway. But I would say, you know, this affects women and trans people. I can't remember where I was going with that.
Well, you know, we're going to have this debate between Alice Drager and Colin Wright, and they're going to try to settle the sex is binary. It's the statement. The claim is biological sex is immutable, binary, and there's one other thing.
Real.
Real. Real, immutable, and binary. And they're going to hash it out.
Not fun, though.
Not fun. Yeah, biological sex is not fun.
That's such an easy debate for Colin Wright because he can just turn up with a binary definition that doesn't have any exceptions and just say it in the opening and then he wins. Apart from, there isn't one, so he can't, so he won't. And that, then it will just be him trying to obfuscate how he doesn't have one. I mean, that I've argued with him before.
And same with Alice. Alice Drager will have a definition that's not binary. And I mean, I feel like we're talking about whether God exists.
Well, I guess you could liken it. So someone will come along and say, I've got proof God exists, and you say, where is it? And then they don't have any, for sure. You know, I do those atheist debates all the time online. I've got a call-in show. But then there's the strong atheist position, which said God definitely doesn't exist, and you would need to provide evidence for that too. I guess I am saying that I'm making the strong assertion that sex isn't binary, because I have spent a lot of time looking into it and trying to understand it.
But you don't want to define sex, because that's not going to lead anywhere, right? We're not going to talk about what is sex, because I would love to ask you what sex is, but you said earlier that that's just going to not go anywhere. So
it can be boring. The thing is, I just do this so often, so much. I assume that people are going to be bored of it, but yeah. I mean, I just say that sex is just the collection of all your sex characteristics. So it just includes all of them. And it's just that ends up in a bimodal distribution.
Yeah. So maybe a good summation would be that your position is that sex is mutable.
Well, yes, because sex is just your sex characteristics and some of them are mutable.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All the important ones for day-to-day life.
Like reproduction. Like
lots of them. Yeah, well, I mean, your reproductive status is mutable because you can go from ability to reproduce to no ability to reproduce, but you can't go from ability to reproduce in one way to another way yet.
Because that's binary. That aspect is binary, right?
Well, it's ternary because there's three positions, isn't there? There's able to do a baby, able to impregnate, and able to not do anything. Badly described, but there is three, you know, there's three statuses of human in terms of reproductive capacity:
fertile male, fertile female, infertile male and female,
infertile
anyone.
Yeah,
once you're infertile, you're not male or female in this model.
If you were to define sex purely by reproductive ability, yeah, which is why I don't, because it's silly, because it would hide misogynistic sexism aspect, which is kind of my main focus. And I think if we get to a position where we can, like trans women are able to get pregnant and give birth, I don't see any gender critical people changing their position.
No, definitely.
If that happens, you bet. Then you've changed sex. I guess it depends. It depends on, like, you haven't, like, if trans women are producing large gametes and.
But can't give birth?
I'm as opposed to like hiring a surrogate or making a artificial womb.
But as a cis woman who doesn't produce gametes and has an artificial womb, I mean, she's female.
Yeah,
I'm not really in favor of women. I'm not in favor of surrogacy.
Oh, I wasn't talking about surrogacy
or artificial wombs. I'm kind of horrified. I've seen those pictures of that lamb and that plastic womb, and it's of nightmares.
Probably, unless human society destroys itself first, which is a real genuine possibility, that we would have, be able to grow in a lab a womb and then transplant it into someone, and probably even be able to grow ovaries and transplant them into someone, and then they. At least by some people's alleged definitions today, would have changed sex. And I guess my point, my step back argument is, whatever your definition of sex is, if you say, Katie, you're not a woman because you don't have X, and then I say, okay, we travel forwards in time to the point where it's 300 years or something, and we've got a load of medical technology, and now I have X, what about my life is changed, which means that suddenly I now deserve rights? Like if I did get like ovaries and a womb transplanted, would now suddenly I be like deserving of being going to a women's shelter more so than the day before I had the operation? Like this is why I think that, you know, this is my general argument, and this is why I think gender critical people in general don't just straw man my position, they just completely don't listen to it and make it up. I think all these sex characteristics, you know, seriously affect your life. I think it'd be ridiculous to say that, like, the ability to get pregnant doesn't have an impact on people's lives, and certainly women as a group, as a whole. and all of your sex characteristics. And like when you're talking about sport, I don't like sport, but you know, sex characteristics, some of them do affect sporting performance. And so when we're coming up with a set of rules for sport, we need to take that into account. But to just declare it's all just strictly tied to like gametes, I mean, just observably false. So that's why when I say sex is real, I'm saying it's real as in it's a complicated mess and we need to look at it all, not just need to pretend it people fit into two boxes.
Okay. But just to characterize GC right now, we're saying developmental pathways now, not chromosomes or gametes.
Well, we are.
We are. So are quite
Nina and I are.
We could say developmental pathways, but I would even say they're not binary because there's different, like developmental pathway isn't it's not an instant, it's a progression over time which can change directions. So I'd say that someone who because like a developmental pathway is like your chromosomes are part of your developmental pathway, and then so is like the hormone levels in the womb, etc. And then there's also growing up and then adolescence and particularly puberty. And there are, for example, even if we just step away from intersex people and all the in the womb stuff, there are trans women who transition before puberty. Mm. And their developmental pathway, I would argue that puberty is a huge part of your developmental pathway. And it's a major factor in your life. And, you know, they, as a group of people, are different in some way to those who transition after puberty, transition during puberty, don't transition at all. Like these are all just, they're not distinctly different groups as in discrete edges. It's all a big fuzzy edge mess, but you know, there are differences there too. And to just like bunch them all together, I think the term developmental pathway hides that.
So we had our conversation about what sex is. And I think that it went about the way that we probably would have predicted, right? This is why it's not a very interesting topic for us. So I want to turn this around and talk about something that matters more to me, which is me and and my friendships. I actually had one of my longtime radical feminist friends block me on Twitter this week because we had a discussion about grooming. And she has a very narrow description of grooming, and it's not just her description. She provided one that's from a group that's trying to actually fight against grooming on the classic meaning of it, I guess, of an adult trying to build a secret relationship with the child in order to promote a sexual contact. I was making allowances that maybe if you have children who are performing in drag clubs for audiences and taking money and having a somewhat sexually charged dancing, that is whatever word for it, that might be something that people might object to for reasons. We couldn't agree, and she blocked me on the basis of that, and I was like, oh, what a blow, this sucks. And I think I told you about this on Twitter as sort of a warm-up to this conversation. And you said that you had also had friendships with gender critical people that kind of ended up falling apart. So I want to ask, because this so far is a genial conversation, I want to ask, is it possible for people with different worldviews to set some of those things aside and nevertheless be friends?
I mean, it's definitely possible for people with different worldviews. I mean, like, I'm an atheist activist, and one of my several of my closest friends are quite dedicated Christians. With some of them, we argue about it all the time. It's like part of our friendship, and others we don't. But I think the big difference there for me, and I genuinely like arguing. I'll argue any position about anything. If I wouldn't do so publicly, but I could argue the gender critical position just theoretically. What makes it different for me is there is nothing about my Christian friends that they want that would negatively affect my life. There's nothing about my friends who have you know, other different worldviews to me, and you know, consider family the most important thing, or consider sports really. Yeah. But you know, there are loads of different worldviews. I'm trying to think of some examples, but Christians are a good one. Nothing they want that affects my life negatively, and there's nothing that I want that affects their life negatively in a like controlling way. Whereas the being gender critical means you want to ruin my life. I mean, that's the bottom line. And I can, I guess what I wanted to do when I set out first talking to gender critical people, 2016, whenever it was, and this may seem kind of weird to hear for a gender critical audience, and maybe even offensive, but I really liked, I had kind of a hero in a way, although I don't like to have heroes, of, I think it's Daryl Davis. He's an African-American man who talks to Ku Klux Klan members and de-radicalizes them. And like his strategy is to just be like, I'm not going to be hostile. I'm just going to be a person and I'm going to humanize myself. And then that de-radicalizes people. And I guess that's how I saw it. I've met transphobic people in real life before. And certainly when I was earlier in transition, when I was kind of obviously trans, sometimes people come up and say things. And I just feel like, and I think this is kind of naive, and it's a belief that I'm really trying to shake, is that I feel like if I just had a drink with someone, if they just hang out with me long enough, they would stop being transphobic and they would stop wanting to ruin my life. But I think that the difficulty is when you have this online, like I guess what Daryl Davis was doing was going to barbecues and hanging out with these people and seeing them all the time. And I can talk to a gender critical person every day. I mean, at the peak of this, I was talking to various gender critical friends most days of the week. But it's just online, and that is different. And it's harder to humanize yourself online. And also, the only time I encounter them is when they're in their like radicalizing bubble. You know, they're on Twitter or they're on Spinster or whatever. And so they can talk to me and they'll be like, oh, maybe KT is a normal person. And then they'll click off our conversation and then it's like, you know, trans person commits crime or whatever, or be jammed in their face. And I think that keeps with the radicalization. But so what I found was we'd agree on all these things. We'd either find a way of discussing, like we're having a reasonable conversation now, or we'd say, let's not talk about this and let's find our commonalities. And certainly I found that rather than gender critical people more, I was seeking out like TERFs, because I feel like we have more in common, because, you know, I feel like I'm quite a passionate feminist and we could agree on so many different things. And then it'll be like, you know, we don't have to, you know, you don't have to say this publicly, you don't have to whatever. I just want to be able to live my life, and I would just don't want a situation where these things are taken away from me and make my life dangerous and where I feel like I have to leave the country. Do you stand with me on that, even in private? And they just wouldn't. And that it's very kind of, it will come down to it where they'll say, well, I'm sorry. And I feel like we're friends. And I had some of them say they feel guilty about it. But the bottom line is that I want to ruin your life. And then that kind of is such a wall in friendships. And maybe it's because I always drill down on these things. I mean, I could exist in a state where we just didn't talk about it, but I'm just too argumentative.
I'm still trying to ruin Corinna's life.
Yeah, the bags of flaming poop on my doorstep are getting a little tiresome. Yeah. It is just cat poop, but nevertheless, Nina.
Yeah, well, you nailed a rat to my door.
I did.
That's a reference.
Die TERFs, is that what I wrote? I forgot.
Something like that. But, you know, friends, you forgive.
It's just a prank. It's interesting to me that you said that you've got Christian friends and they're not trying to ruin your life. Of course, I have Christian friends as well that
different
are
in America.
Yeah. Aside from the, again, more poop on my door.
Yeah. The flaming crosses and swastikas.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
No, I've had to start ordering fire extinguishers on Amazon Prime Subscribe and Save. So it's 10% off though. So that's okay. There are sects of Christianity that are absolutely opposed to public participation of LGBT people.
Period. Or of women.
Or women, but I mean just looking at the LGBT part.
Yeah.
Because you're right, there's even more extremes of Christians that are like that. But here in the United States, I wouldn't surprise me if 10 or 15% of Christians believe that there shouldn't be public participation of gays or lesbians, that that mm-hmm. that all should be suppressed. That wouldn't shock me at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's very different in the UK. I think our people don't talk about their religion, and those who do, like, Christianity is much more moderate here. We do have the crazy people, but not in the same scale. But I think, I don't know if this is a bit of a sidetrack, but this is kind of why I do this atheist activism stuff, is I remember watching some of these atheist videos, and there was this straight cis man saying how when he came out as an atheist and how his struggles were like coming out as an LGBT person, my initial impression was like, fuck off. Like, being an atheist was a deal for me. Like, I came out to myself as an atheist, so I would describe it now. But coming out as trans was like way worse. But then I heard his story, and like, he got kicked out of his family, he got kicked out of his church, he lost his job, he got chased out of his town. I was like, this is the same. And you do meet these yeah. extreme people, and I'm totally able to be friends with a Christian, all the Christians I've ever met, in fact, because none of them are like that. None of them have disowned me in coming out as trans. None of them have tried to ruin my life. And, that, you know, that I feel like that's, if I want to be friends with someone, the bare minimum they need is to not want to ruin my life. And it's just very hard to find in gender critical people. I mean, maybe.
Just
maybe
could you imagine, could though, that in this current battle where women are losing their sex-based spaces and protections, that they see, yeah, I know, right wing, that they see trans activists as ruining their lives. Because yeah, wow, if I go to jail, you know, I could be housed with a male prisoner. If I go to a domestic violence shelter, there could be a male person there. And if I'm seeking, you know, a group therapy for domestic violence, I've been traumatized by men, and I will no longer have an all-female refuge that I can go to. And so they could see this movement as ruining their lives. The people are trying to ruin their lives, women's lives.
I'm well aware that that's the response, and it's, I'm trying not to project bad faith on you. I guess that at least some people, I feel like the strategy is to just kind of say what we're saying to them back. But I'm not saying you're doing that. But I think that there's some big differences here in the power dynamics and, you know, what the current situation is today. So trans women, at least in the UK, there's never been a law against us using women's toilets, and we've been protected to do so since like the 70s or something. And the same with other women's spaces, certainly since 1999. And now with the Equality Act in 2010, you know, this is the status quo. And what I want in terms of women's spaces is that. So what I want doesn't ruin anyone's life because that's the life they already lead. Whereas if they want to ban me from all these spaces, then that does affect my life. So in terms of specifically for spaces, the status quo is not being upended by me. But also, if it was me who was upending status quo, maybe we found somewhere where trans women are explicitly banned, like North Carolina in 2016 or something. The difference still, there's still a big difference here in that if I am in a situation where I am breaking the law, if I go to the women's toilets and like walking into a room full of men for the men's toilets, and sorry, I'm using toilets again.
I know, I was going to say, can you please just use some example other than toilets? Because it's a red herring. Rooms. It's not the reason, what we're, let's say jail, okay, or a domestic violence shelter.
Yeah, okay, so but if I'm faced with this situation in my day-to-day life where I'm facing breaking the law or putting my safety at risk, that isn't comparable, I think, to the day-to-day lives of cis women being in a situation where one in 300 times there might be a trans woman there. Because for a number of things, one is being in a situation where you're the one trans woman in a room full of men is very different to being you're a cis woman in a room full of cis women and one trans woman just by numbers, but also by the fact that, I mean, trans women aren't the same as cis men, and I am not a danger to you, etc.
Well, what about, okay, so we should talk about passing, actually. So passing is something people, that it's like verboten, right? And we're talking about modern trans activism as opposed to old school transsexualism where people passed and that was sort of like cool. It was like, you know, maybe you could clock someone, but they were clearly most people passed and you just didn't do it. Whereas modern trans activism has, you know, you just declare your identity and then, you know, I think one of the concerns about modern trans activism is like any man, it opens the door to any man, like what you would call a cis man who claims a trans identity is as entitled to female spaces as you are with, you know, who has put effort into passing.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about passing if you like. It's always interesting hearing people telling me, like, oh, this is what modern trans activism is about. Half the time I'm like held up as like some kind of stereotype of the worst kind of trans rights activist. And then the other half the time I'm being told the worst bits of trans rights activism aren't really things that I'm saying. But, you know, I get that there's some people saying some things. My response to passing, I guess, is that passing is like a safety thing primarily for a lot of people, and as well as like physical safety, but just kind of like moving through society effortlessly and avoiding transphobia. If someone doesn't read you as trans, your life is just easier. So there's a lot of pressure to pass, and that was kind of what trans people of years past have been responding to generally. I'm aware that that's not entirely true for everyone, because for some people it's like an ideological thing. But I think as soon as you put value in passing, then you're putting value in sexist stereotypes and saying that these things are good. And you must, if I was to change my presentation and, you know, like try and pass as a man and go out of my way to do so, I mean, I don't know if I could or not. You can have your own opinion on that. I don't really need to know. That wouldn't be, you know, that's just a changing presentation thing. And suddenly I could be described by maybe gender critical people as like some kind of worse trans person. Like, I'm more of a problem now. What they're saying is you must adhere to these stereotypes in order to have some kind of rights. And that's why I feel like ideologically opposed to demands to pass. And I mean, it is a fact that the more you meet stereotypes, the more you pass. Like, there's a strong, when you experiment with that in reality, that's certainly earlier in transitioning. If you wear a dress and makeup, you pass a lot better. That's just a sad fact of reality. So, and like you say, putting effort in, I mean, the effort that I have put in to passing is maybe, like, specifically, maybe my voice, I guess. But I haven't, other than that, my effort that I put in is to manage my own gender dysphoria and then my just general presentation to society as a person who, like, you know, has a shower, etc. I wouldn't ever want to be in a position where I felt like I was putting effort in to meet some kind of standard because it made me more deserving of human rights. But then when, like, to say about this kind of opens it to any man thing, I get that that's like the framing, but I just don't think that reflects real life. I mean, like, when people come out, like when I came out, I didn't pass. I wasn't saying, you know, like the day before I came out to myself, if someone asked me, or maybe like the year before, are you a man or a woman? I would have said, well, I'm a man, like reluctantly. Because, you know, that was the reality of my life. And today I would say, I'm a woman. And at some point in there, you know, there was some slow changeover. But I didn't like come out to myself and then be like instantly, aha, now I'm going to go to women's shelters, because I'm aware of like how society works, and trying to, you know, transition and manage my life involves being aware of those things. And that's the, like, the law and also the tradition that we've had in the UK for as long as I've been alive. And for sure, the amount of transphobia in society has gone down and then kind of down and up at the same time, which means trans people can kind of be more open about themselves. But I don't think we're in this situation where it's like, oh, previously there was these laws or even strong societal rules where this is what was done and suddenly we're breaking them all apart. I think that this just always been the case and people are just more aware of what a trans person in transition is like now. Because like even, you know, in the 70s when trans women were coming out and it was like pass or die, they still would have had years of transition. You know, the middle state where they wouldn't have been passing and they would have been trying to navigate free society where they're trying not to be attacked by cis men and they're trying not to, you know, get in a situation where they're causing a stir around a group of cis women. It's difficult times.
So you think there's nothing to the gender critical argument that these laws create or that these protections for you, right, to just live your life, create opportunities for what you would call cis men to harm women, to access spaces, you know, to, for example, in a men's prison, there's this huge increase of male prisoners who identify as trans so that they can go to women's prisons and they rape women.
They're left-handed too, Nina.
Yes, where they rape women, right? It's like, gee, who would have thought that would happen? And it's like, no, you know, no person would ever lie or, you know, claim a trans identity for any reason other than that they're genuinely, deeply, and profoundly actually trans.
I think we need to like pick individual rights on this to discuss because to say it in general, I mean, the UK Equality Act, which came in 2010, like gives trans women rights to women's spaces, but has room for case by case exceptions in terms of things like shelters and prisons, and also allows sporting organisations to make up their own rules. And so, if someone lived somewhere and they're like, and again, I know that it's like, oh, the toilets and changing rooms argument, but if someone says, oh, this would allow this to happen, or, oh, we're suddenly allowing trans women to change their passports, or, oh, we're suddenly allowing trans women to change their birth certificates. The thing is, we can just look at the reality of countries that already have that and say, no, allowing trans women to have an F on their passport does not lead to any kind of shenanigans, because who would it benefit? It doesn't benefit anyone. It's literally just a way of, you need this in order to navigate through society in a way that's as frictionless as possible. Then when we come to things like prisons, for example, I think that the argument is often, oh well, trans people asking for, in quotes, self ID, where anyone just says anything and then everyone just has to, you know, go along with it, otherwise you'll be cancelled on social media or whatever. That's often framed when we're talking about GRA reform, Gender Recognition Act in the UK. And this is about allowing trans people to change their birth certificate, which allows you to then change your marriage certificate and death certificate, etc. That isn't affecting prisons, because prisons is determined by the Equality Act. I know, sorry, this is very English-centred, but what I'm saying here is this Equality Act, which sorts the placement of prisoners, has been in place now for 12 years. And there's been one major scandal in the UK around this, when they didn't follow the regulations they already had in place in terms of a trans woman sexually assaulting a cis woman in prison, which, you know, we don't really have time to go much more into. But in terms of trans women being sexually assaulted and raped in prisons, that's just a complete non-issue. No one cares at all. And, you know, some of these stories are unimaginably horrific. And it's the same as if you were to just lock a cis woman in a prison with a load of men, just raped continuously, and then like, it won't even be a news article, let alone a headline. And I think, yeah, whenever we're discussing these things, I mean, it's almost like the entire framing is, oh well, this is about whether we, you know, allow trans people to assert themselves onto us or not. There's no kind of consideration of the trans, you know, trans people's existence at all. But yeah, certainly when we say like, oh, well, this change will allow this. I mean, which change? Because there's a lot of different rules in different places with different consequences. And maybe this is a bad time to bring it when it's sort of, we're like 5 minutes to the end. But, you know, it is, I think it is very specific. And an example is like when Jordan Peterson was going off about Bill C-16 in Canada and how, you know, allowing trans rights was going to be the end of free speech in Canada. And it just wasn't. It's just total nonsense. And I can address that, and I can say having trans people in some kind of anti-hate speech, anti-hate crime legislation alongside gay people, women, and people of color does not cause a problem. There are no loopholes that are obviously being exploited. That's an example. Another one is passports. Trans women can get female passports on self-ID in the UK. That's our main form of ID. People aren't exploiting it because there's nothing to exploit. So it just, you know, it depends on the thing, basically. And then we can go into more detail, but I don't think that there's any of my positions that I'm advocating for where that's an issue, because otherwise I wouldn't be advocating for them.
Katie, this has been a very good and productive conversation. I'm glad you came to join us.
Same here. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me talk like 99% of the time.
That's what you're here for. That's what we wanted to hear you talk. Thank you so much.
For people who want to know more about your writing or your positions or your projects, where should they go?
I would say go to Twitter, because that's my main thing, but Twitter's kind of dying now, so I don't know. I am at Katie Montgomery on most of the things. If you want to read my writing, I'm on Medium. I have my own website. I'm on YouTube. I do videos. My main series is coming back soon. It's called Turf Wars, where we discuss the anti-trans nonsense of the week. And I'm trying to start up on Mastodon, but it's currently offline, so hopefully it'll be online by the time this podcast comes out. Just do me a Google and you'll probably find me.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks, TERFs and Trannies.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.